We appreciate it. 800-222-9739, and let me just make sure I say the right thing, $365 to go, $365 to go. You can do that. That's one person doing a dollar a day package, you know, one person pledging at the sustaining level of about $30 a month or $25 a month. Please, make that call that makes a difference right now before we go to Ethelbert Miller and On the Margin. 800-222-9739. Keep the calls coming for Democracy Now! You can also go to the website, wpfwfm.org. Make that call that makes the difference. Support that which supports you in Democracy Now! Keep the calls coming for Democracy Now! And as we move in to Ethelbert Miller's On the Margin, you are in tune to WPFW Washington.
Welcome to On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is Edward B. Henderson II. He is the author of The Grandfather of Black Basketball, The Life and Times of Dr. E. B. Henderson. How are you doing today, Edward?
I'm doing wonderful. Thanks for having me.
You're joining us at the time when we're having this spring fundraising drive, and people will probably be listening to all the wonderful things you have to share with us this morning. And I know they'll be calling 202-588-9739, 202-588-9739, or 1-800-222-9739. Edward, you were born and grew up in Tuskegee, Alabama, a place of historical importance when it comes to African-American culture. Talk about your Tuskegee experience and compare it to what your grandfather experienced growing up in D.C., especially in terms of going to the M Street High School and the Minor Teachers College.
I'll try to answer that. Both of my parents are from the Washington, D.C. area. My mother is an old African-American family of Washington. And my father was born here in Falls Church, where I live in the home of my grandfather, Dr. E.B. Henderson, which is now a historical landmark. Growing up in Tuskegee, though, was a very rich African-American cultural experience, with the history there, Booker T. Washington and George Washington Carver, among others, Tuskegee Airmen as well. My father was the director of the George Washington Carver Research Foundation, and he worked with the cells of Henrietta Lacks for the polio vaccine in the early to mid-50s. And so I was always around the university. I basically grew up on the university campus. But my mother was also a professor of early childhood education and was the director of the nursery school there on campus. I went to the laboratory school on campus, Chambliss Children's House. And so the university was my oyster. It was my world. And my grandmother, E.B.'s wife, her sister actually married Booker T. Washington's son, Ernest Davidson, or Dave Washington, in 1914. And my grandfather was the one who gave her away because her father had passed. So I grew up in Tuskegee, and my grandparents actually moved there in 1965, so the last 10 to 12 years of their lives, we lived under the same roof. And I think that's where my love for history came from. My family's always been very meticulous about genealogy and family history, so.
You know, that's why I asked you this question, mm-hmm. because you know, one of the things when I went down to Tuskegee, is that you actually can see the grave of Booker T. Washington, George Washington Carver. They're buried on the campus.
Yes.
So
yes.
You can't bypass the history.
Yeah, and the monument there is iconic, Booker T. Washington, and there's a George Washington Carver Museum, which was actually funded by Henry Ford. Henry Ford was a big fan of George Washington Carver and tried to lure him away. But there's no Booker T. Washington Museum. I guess you could say that the campus is his museum. And another connection to Tuskegee is Robert Taylor, who was an MIT architect who designed all of the buildings there on campus. He's also the great-grandfather of Valerie Jarrett, who was the senior, who was the senior advisor for Obama and is now the CEO and director of the Obama Foundation. So there's a lot of connections there.
There's a lot of connections there. I'm just trying to figure all this out. There's a tremendous amount of connections there.
Yes.
But I wanted to have you provide what you just did. And then I wanted you to contrast, because it's such a rich history when we look at the M Street School and the Minor Teachers College. And this is in your book, The Grandfather of Black Basketball.
Yes. Well, you know, we have a very unique educational legacy here in Washington, D.C., in that one of the earliest high schools in the country was the preparatory school for African-American girls, which was conducted in the basement of the 15th Street Presbyterian Church. And out of that grew M Street, which was built in 1891 and was the first building of a high school here in Washington, D.C. There are several other schools, the Sumner School, the Wormley School, who I'm actually related to through my mother's side of the family, John R. Francis Junior High School. But a high school was, like here in Virginia, you know, like after you finish seventh grade, if you wanted to pursue further studies, you would be shipped off to the Jenny Dean School or the industrial school, vocational school. But anyone interested in higher education or an academic line of study would have to use a Washington, D.C. address and then travel to Washington, D.C., or live in Washington, D.C., to attend the schools there. And so this was the environment. But Washington, D.C. had public schools, and Charles Sumner actually wanted integrated schools after the Civil War, but the Congress wouldn't go for that. But he did develop a Washington, D.C. colored school system, and that's the system which E.B. Henderson was involved in or was taught in.
You know, there's so much what I enjoyed about your book, The Grandfather of Black Basketball, is that it's not just the family history in terms of you talking about your grandfather, but you revised so much other important African-American history. And I wanted you to talk about three things, which I sort of pulled out of the beginning chapters of your book. First is the Pearl incident of 1848, because you mentioned, you said in the book that there were some of your ancestors involved in that.
Yes, on my mother's side of the family. And I hope you forgive me for delving into genealogy.
No, this is wonderful.
But I think that it was important to give a broad a perspective on Washington, D.C. And in 1848, on tax day, April 15th, 77 African, enslaved people. They got on this boat, the Pearl, a schooner called the Pearl, and tried to escape to freedom. And the incident, they were caught. They were marched through the streets of Washington, D.C. with insults thrown at them. And then they were placed in auction house. Well, they had a slave penitentiary in Baltimore. Then they were sent down to New Orleans. One of the worst threats to enslaved people was, we're going to sell you down south. Because the average person of a slave down south was about 7 years. They would work you to death and beat you if you didn't you know, keep up your quota. But I've done particularly research into African-American history. My major from Tuskegee was a degree in history. Mm-hmm. And the Pearl Incident happened in 1848, and it's probably responsible for the Compromise of 1850, the Fugitive Slave Act. But also, one of the people that was involved in this effort was Ward Beecher, Harriet Beecher Stowe's brother, who was the pastor of a church in New York City, and the father of the Edmondsons, who was, he was free. He was a free man of color. He actually went to New York to try to get help for his two daughters, who were part of the slave escape. And he impressed on Ward Beecher that he feared for his daughters because they were pretty girls and they'd probably be used as prostitutes or other kinds of atrocities that African-American women in particular faced in the slavery, in the institution of slavery. Well, he went to his church and they raised the money to buy these two girls out of slavery, out of the auction house that was in Alexandria. Maybe I wasn't clear. There was disease at the slave holding in New Orleans, and they were sent back here to Alexandria. And Bruin and Hill was the name of the auction house. And the auction, you know, Virginia took back their land. That was part of the District of Columbia because there was a rumor, thanks to a bill by Abraham Lincoln in the 1840s, to free the slaves in the District of Columbia. And that's when the state of Virginia decided, oh, we're going to have to take our land back.
Our land back.
We can't have that because Alexandria, our slave holding, and Virginia itself was a slave breeding state. The upper South, once tobacco was no longer the major cash crop, they could find that breeding slaves and selling them down South was very profitable. They could double their money, if not triple their money, because of the need for bodies, the need for African Americans in the South to pick cotton. But Harriet Beecher Stowe also wrote about the Pearl Incident as well. And this was also an impetus for Matilda Minor to create her school here in Washington, D.C., which is now the University of District of Columbia. So there's a lot of connection. And DuPont Circle was an area that was actually, Matilda Minor received a grant of money, and where she was able to buy 3 acres in what is now DuPont Circle, and that's where her school started. Mm-hmm. And so
you're filled with so much history that I was going to ask you about three. No, this is wonderful. But I was also going to ask you about Berry Farms and also the True Reformers Hall. But I'm going to put that aside because I want to get to your grandfather. But this is an excellent, and I want to tell people that you're listening to Edward B. Henderson II, and this is our spring fundraising drive, and you've hearing a phenomenal amount of information that you can only get on a place at WPFW. So try to support us. Our number here is 202-588-9739, 202-588-9739, 1-800-222-9739. As we segue into discussion of your grandfather, Edwin, talk first about Dudley Allen Sargent and his ideas about physical fitness and health.
Dudley Allen Sargent was a medical doctor who believed that exercise is medicine. And he started a athletic club or gymnasium in New York City, and he invented all manner of apparatus for exercise, such as many people know the rowing machine and many of the other apparatuses were the ones where you use pulleys and weights. And he was associated with the Springfield College as well, where they invented the game of basketball. And at Harvard, he took over in the late 1800s, the Hemingway Gymnasium, and his school of the Dudley Sargent School for Physical Training. And in the late 1800s, he started this school, and there were many people who actually went there who weren't interested in being certified to teach, such as Teddy Roosevelt and Booker T. Washington, just because they wanted to learn how to better take care of themselves, you know, in physical fitness. And so he started this school, and the first person from Washington to go there was Miss Anita Turner. And she was the physical director of physical education in the colored schools, and also at the minor normal school as well. And she is the one who encouraged my E.B. Henderson, my grandfather, to go to Harvard to gain his certification to teach physical education, and then come back to the schools in Washington, D.C. And it was there that Anita Turner was probably the first African-American to be certified to teach physical education in the United States, whereas my grandfather, E.B. Henderson, became the first African-American male to be certified to teach physical education in the United States.
What attracted him to go to Harvard?
Well, I think, number one, it was the encouragement of Anita Turner, mm-hmm. Who was actually using basketball with her female students in the college school system as a physical education exercise, but not necessarily as a competitive sporting entity.
Well, that's one of the things that you find out in your book, that basketball started as a women's sport.
Right. And in 1904, at the St. Louis World's Fair, and that same year, the St. Louis Olympics, the game was officially introduced to the general public. Before that, it was basically held and housed within the YMCAs and the YWCAs. And it was not widely popular. Matter of fact, it wasn't widely popular probably until the 1980s with Larry Bird and Magic Johnson, you know, at least profitability-wise. Mm-hmm. But basketball was introduced then. And then E.B. Henderson, he learned the game. He realized that this was significant, that this was something that African Americans can do and probably be better at than others. I think the thing that attracted him most was that the goal was a vertical goal, not a horizontal goal, and that everybody knows the saying, white man can't jump. Some can, mm-hmm. but there was a statement that E.B. Henderson said in the 1911 Crisis Magazine, summer edition, July of 1911, where he said, and I'm paraphrasing, mind you, that when the Negro is afforded competent physical directors and equal access to facilities, the white athlete will find a equal or superior in every athletic endeavor. our minds say that that's true in science, math, and any other discipline as well. But his area was sports.
But you know what I found interesting in your book, Edward, is that the whole growth of basketball is also because, in terms of for the men, well, how do you keep them in shape between like football and baseball seasons?
That was the main reason that Luther Gulick, who started the public school athletic league in New York City, he was a he hired James Naismith from Canada,
Mr. Basketball.
Yeah, the inventor of basketball, to create a game that would keep his athletes in shape during the off seasons, football in the fall, baseball in the spring and the summer. But in the winter months, he felt that his athletes got flabby and out of shape. And therefore, basketball was created. And but being that it's a winter sport, in order to play the game, you really required an indoor facility, something that Washington, D.C. really did not have for African Americans. There was the Central Y, but blacks couldn't go there. And it turned out that the only place where they could go was the ballroom of the True Reformers Hall, which could be converted into a basketball court.
And that's at 12th and U Street.
At 12th and U Street. Now, the court was not a regulation court, though, written 94 by 50. And even when they finished the 12th Street YMCA, that court was also not a regulation court. But it was designed for basketball.
You know, this is sort of like a minor thing, but I circled it when I was reading your book. When your grandfather was up at Harvard, one of the people that he runs into is Josiah Royce. And I said, oh, Josiah Royce, this is the guy who's responsible for like the beloved community.
Right, right. You know, he my grandfather was very much an intellectual. His mother taught him to read and write at a very young age. And when he was at Harvard, I have to feel that his personality and his intellect made it easy for him to meet people, make friends make friends and influence people. And many of the things that of the people that he met and the lessons that he learned, he was able to bring back to Washington, D.C. and institute, such as, you know, starting the first league. he started the first league basically out of necessity because James E. Sullivan, the president of the AAU, encouraged him to do so because they weren't going to allow black teams to play against their white teams. They said, you start your own league, you know. Right. And so he did.
Right. Well, before we talk about the league creation.
Yes, okay.
I want you to talk about, okay, here your grandfather comes back. Okay, and as you mentioned, he's one of the first African American males to be certified to teach physical education in D.C. But there's also concern at this particular time about the health conditions of the black community. And so talk yes. about that.
Well, in the early, the late 19th century and the early 20th century, we're in the throes of the Great Migration. Okay, the beginning of the Great Migration, really. And many of the conditions for many of the African-Americans who were coming up from the South and migrating here was overcrowded and unsanitary conditions. And this led to many sedentary lifestyle diseases, such as tuberculosis, dysentery, and the like. And the he felt that physical education and exercise would be a public health initiative that he would promote to help alleviate some of the possibilities of contracting some of these diseases. However, there was a time in Washington, D.C., when several of the public spaces in certain neighborhoods were not open to the African-American population. And that wouldn't change until the 1930s with the advent of the New Deal and the Federal Security Agency, which started a committee here in Washington to open up all of those.
Well, let me ask you this question, Edward Henderson II. I like saying that. When you look at what your grandfather was trying to do back then, we were just talking about the health conditions in terms of the African community back then. You tied it in with the Great Migration. It seems like in 2024, we talk about basketball and sports, but we don't talk about it in terms of health issues.
That's true. And a lot of physical education today seems like recess rather than really physical education.
Right, recess, exactly.
Education.
Yeah.
That was not my grandfather's idea when he was the director of physical education, health and safety here in Washington, D.C. schools. But the early leagues in basketball were amateur. In other words, even though my grandfather really loved the game of basketball and we watched many games together, the overarching philosophy was amateurism, because they felt that money would ruin the sport.
We see that today.
You know, it can be said, yes. You know, but how else would it exist in our environment? But amateurism was the rule of the day, and that really didn't. There was a team that an early professional team that didn't last around 1910, but in the 1920s, professionalism took off. And Bob Douglas, should I say, mm-hmm. with the New York Wrens was the winningest basketball team of the early 20th century.
Hmm. Well, I want to encourage our people before we take a break, Edward B. Henderson II, to call 202-588-9739, 202-588-9739, or 1-800-222-9739 to support us here at WPFW during our spring fundraising drive. I'm talking this morning to Edward B. Henderson II. He's the author of The Grandfather of Black Basketball, The Life and Times of Dr. E.B. Henderson. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The show's On the Margin. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
Hi, this is Jim Byers, host of the Latin Flavor Classic Edition. We're seeking 4 new members per hour to make a pledge of support for WPFW. Our loyal, renewing members are the station's lifeblood, but we need everyone on board in order for the station to thrive. If you've never pledged before, I invite you to join the WPFW family today. Whether you've been listening for one day or for 47 years, won't you join now to ensure that this broadcasting treasure continues to serve our community? Call 1-800-222-9739 and help WPFW continue to build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Okay, we're back on the air with Edward B. Henderson II. Edward, I want you to take us back to 1907 and 1908, because that's like where you really see the championship there, team there on 12th and U Street.
Okay. Well, in 1906, E.B. Henderson was instrumental in starting the first African-American athletic league, the Interscholastic Athletic Association of Mid-Atlantic States. That was in 1906. In 1907, the New York City African-American Athletic Clubs, they started a league of their own, the Olympian Athletic League. And they basically challenged each other to a tournament so that African Americans would have a championship to aspire to. At some point, this became known as the Colored Basketball World Championship. The first two teams, the first two couple of years, Washington, D.C. was represented by an athletic club here called the Crescent Club. But they were not up to par for some of the New York teams, in particular this team, the Smart Set of Brooklyn, who captured the first two colored basketball world championships. In 1909-1910, though, for that season, the Smart Set of Brooklyn's best player, a guy named Hudson Oliver, or Huddy Oliver, wanted to be a doctor. So where did he come? He came to Howard University. I mean, he could have gone to Meharry, maybe, but he came to Howard University. And many of the players on the first team out of 12th Street YMCA were Howard University students.
Yes, sir. Charles drew in one of these pitches.
Yeah, but that was at Dunbar.
Okay.
That was at Dunbar because Charles Drew went to Amherst.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But in 1908, Teddy Roosevelt laid the cornerstone of the 12th Street YMCA, but there was no building. Okay. So even though they were called the Washington 12th Streeters, there was no building there at the 12th Street YMCA. But what
that's
they
like some
did,
kind of joke or something.
No, what they were doing was that they were, through the proceeds that they would receive from playing the game, the proceeds went to helping to build the 12th Street YMCA. Mm. Okay. And my grandfather was a physical trainer. And so he whipped these guys into great shape, and they would run of these teams off of the floor. And in New York, they defeated all of the teams of New York and brought home to Washington, D.C. its first basketball championship. I'm claiming that. I don't think anybody can dispute it. If they can, feel free to correct me. and the following year, though, for the beginning of the 1910-1911 series, the first game was a kickoff at the New York Casino. And my grandparents, it was on Christmas Day. My grandparents, my grandfather promised to my grandmother that he would not play once they were married. And so, because my grandmother was going to have to give up being a teacher. So he would have to give up something too. So he made that promise to her. So they got married on Christmas Eve, 1910, and then caught the train up to New York City. All of the accommodations were paid for by the host team, and therefore their travel and their accommodations were paid for, and they would have their honeymoon in New York City. Well, on that day, the St. Christopher team, the guy that my grandfather was playing against, the center on the team, my grandfather was considered the best center in basketball in 1909-1910. All 5'10" of him. A very different game back
different
then.
Different game, right.
But the guy was really beating up on my grandfather. And I think my grandmother might have put something on him that night. And he had no legs. And so he got a young, taller boy that was on the team. Said, you take the center position, and I'll take the forward position along with Huddy Oliver, and we'll distribute the ball. And you tip off the ball and fight against this guy that's killing me. And then after the game, he announced to the team that he would no longer play. And he petitioned Howard University to accept the team as their first varsity team. And so the team that won in 1910-11 was the Howard University team.
Take us back to really how this, the purpose of this book and the process that you undertook to get your grandfather into the Hall of Fame. There must have been a point where you're listening and you get a sense of who your grandfather is, and it just must be like he must be being overlooked. And so I'm just wondering, in terms of your pride in your grandfather, in terms of, you know, your love for him, but then you also say, okay, I'm going to make sure, as the grandson, I'm going to do this.
Yeah, you know, he had been overlooked for so long and recognized for other things, such as he always felt that he was going to remember for anything, it would be writing The Negro in Sports at the behest of Dr. Carter G. Woodson. However, this history existed, but it was kind of in the background for so long. And when we pushed it out there, you know, my wife and I, we created a 138-page booklet. I made 28 copies, sent that up to Springfield, Mass. Before the Hall of Fame. And nothing happened. We asked the curator what went on, and he said, nobody knew who he was. And so we embarked on a educational, you know, to educate people. I mean, all of the documentation was solid. Mm-hmm. We had letters of recommendation from Henry Louis Gates, John Hope Franklin, Earl Lloyd, who was the first African-American to play in the NBA, Dave Bing, and people like that. But no one recognized it. And the thing they always ask me is, what team did he play for? Mm-hmm. And is there any videotape of him playing?
Well, you know, one person I thought would, when you mentioned what you're saying, the one person I would figure would be maybe really involved would be Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Because he has such a history for the love for the history of the game.
I agree. I don't know that we actually tried to get to him. I think we may have, but we couldn't get through the buffers. Mm-hmm. But the thing that we did after the first year was that, realizing that no one turned a page, we decided to do a 7-minute video and burn 28 DVDs and set that up. Mm-hmm. And then the following year, we got footage from the Today Show when Arthur Ashe was talking about his book, Hard Road to Glory. Mm-hmm. And Brian Gumbel asked him, well, why'd you do this book? Surely this has been done before. And Arthur said, yes, the first one to do it was Edwin Henderson, the first publicly appointed gym teacher in the Washington, D.C. colored schools. So we took that footage, put it in the video. We got footage from Sheila Johnson, mm-hmm. you know, of the Washington Mystics. And we made it about 8.5 minutes, and we burned 28 more DVDs and sent that up there. The next year, YouTube became a reality, and we just sent the link. Mm-hmm. And the year after that, we asked the Hall of Fame, should we send another nomination? They said, no, don't send us anything else. We have more than enough to make a decision. Mm-hmm. But the owner of the Harlem Globetrotters, a man named Manny Jackson, became the chair of the Basketball Hall of Fame. And he instituted a special elect category for African-American pioneers. And that's how E.B. Henderson got in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, compare getting your grandfather into the Hall of Fame with you getting this book, The Grandfather of Black Basketball, published, because I saw a little note in the beginning that you must have sent this over to Georgetown University Press.
I did, yeah.
And they didn't accept it.
Well, we were going through the process, and there was a peer reviewer who questioned my writing, questioned my research, question my objectivity, whether I would be able to write something objective about my grandfather. But basically, at the end of his review, he said, "You're not the one to write the book." And
he probably was a hockey fan.
Who knows? You know, I have things that no one else had. When I moved into the house here, there was a box in the attic that had a treasure trove of things that Howard University doesn't have, which is where he donated a lot of his papers. We had a whole different set of documents photo albums and things like that. Even if I hadn't gone to the Moreland Spring Garden, the National Archives, the Library of Virginia, the courthouse in Fairfax, Virginia, and many other places, I would have been more researched on my grandfather than anyone. Mm-hmm. Okay, and I dare say that this gentleman was suffering from a degree of intellectual bigotry, which I think a lot of professors do in academia. But it lit a fire under me to be the one to write the book. Mm-hmm. It did not discourage me. It upset me a bit, mm-hmm. you know, but after a while I got over that and I decided, you know, to tweak a few things and make it so that my book was credible.
Well, talk about this process, because I'm certain there are many people listening to us who say, well, you know, I have all of this family history, you know, and how do I turn it into a story? You know, if we go back to the beginning of our show, your interest in terms of African-American history, you give us the bigger picture, and then you seem to put your grandfather in it. But talk about that process.
I'm a big advocate for context. I was a U.S. history teacher in Fairfax County Public Schools. And I always felt that the backstory or the background story was as, in many terms, as interesting and vital as the story itself. And therefore, I tried to include as much in the periphery of his life as well as the things that were his life and many of the things that were in my life as well. I think growing up with him and being named for him held certain realities that other people probably would not know or would not care about. Mm. And therefore, I tried to fashion a story because my parents had written a book in 1985, but it was 40 pages long with 100 pages of indices. Mm. And I said, Grandpa deserves more than this. Mm. And even my own sister told me, you don't need to write this book. Mom and Dad already wrote this book. I said, not the way I'm going to write it.
Right. Well, let me ask you this. We're here, you know, in Washington, D.C. and in the area. If I went down to the African-American Museum, National African-American Museum, does your grandfather have a presence there? Is your book like in the bookstore there? I'm just wanting to figure out in terms of, you know, being overlooked, but now we have the story out. He's in the Hall of Fame. If we go into, like, say, these museums, is he present there?
Well, the Basketball Hall of Fame does have the book. Okay. I need to check on and see if I can get it in the National Museum of African American History and Culture. His book is in the Negro in Sports. A copy of that is in the basketball section in the museum. Mm-hmm. So he has a small presence there. And I know Damian Thomas is a big fan of sports and social justice, and also a big fan of my grandfather's. He's actually come to my house and ask me for certain things, of which I said I would let him borrow, but not I wasn't going to donate them. Actually, I'd be willing to donate some of the stuff now because I feel it needs a home.
When you look at this book coming out now, and you know, we're talking right now during the, you know, playoffs that's taking place, it seems like this is the type of book that if I'm the NBA and I have a new draft class coming in, that this should be required reading. You know, I also look at the fact that, you know, we're just celebrating, you know, the interest in, you know, women's basketball, starting with the NCAA tournament and not the WNBA. When we mentioned what we said in this show here, that basketball was a women's sport, it seems like this is also an ideal time to celebrate the history.
Well, ironically, or maybe not so, Dawn Staley was in the same class 2013 along with E.B. Henderson. And so I'm really a big fan of her. She is such a class act. I just think that, you know, the Washington Wizards have two programs that they run to honor E.B. Henderson. One's an essay contest. The other one is an award for the player who does the most for philanthropy and social justice. But this is not just a Washington Wizards or Washington, D.C. story.
Right.
This is something that should be honored by the whole of the NBA and the basketball community. In October, I was invited up to Cambridge, Massachusetts, for an event hosted by the Harvard University basketball coach, Tommy Hammacher. Mm-hmm. And the guest speaker of that event was Adam Silver, the commissioner of the NBA. And Tommy, Mr. Hammacher, allowed me a couple of minutes to talk about my grandfather and his connection to Harvard and the book. Mm-hmm. And afterwards, the commissioner of the NBA said that they would help to promote the book. They're not in the business of writing reviews and promoting books, though. But when I did send an email to Adam Silver at NBA.com, the very next day, he assigned someone to get back with me. I was very encouraged by that. And they are actively helping me in various ways to promote the book and to get the book out.
Hmm. Well, you know, when I think about getting the book out and I think of what the league is doing and how basketball is an international game, it seems as if that, you know, has there been an interest in terms of your book being translated into, say, French or any other language?
Well, that's up to the publisher, and it would depend on the demand. I know from looking at WorldCat, which is a library monitoring organization, that my book is in libraries in Australia, Botswana, Germany, and there's one author of a book that just came out in France who also speaks a lot about E.B. Henderson. Mm-hmm. And on the cover is the picture of the 1922 Dunbar team with Charles Drew that E.B. coached. Mm-hmm. And so when he actually did a program at the D.C. History Conference several years ago, and I went to see his presentation, and I invited him to come to the house and spend the night here. And he looked at, went through some of the archival boxes that we had of things of E.B. Henderson. And ironically, he lives in a town in outside of Paris that my same place where my family lived when my father was on sabbatical and working at a laboratory in France. Mm-hmm. And so I'm looking to reach out to him and see if we can do a dual presentation or something, maybe in France at some point.
Right. Well, you know, I got to ask you something, Dad. I should have asked you maybe in the beginning of this program, because it's, you know, your grandfather influence on you. Do you have game? I mean, how would you? You could have been like maybe like a baseball player or somebody in the family, but you know, you were surrounded by basketball. But what about you and your interest in actually playing sports?
Well, my interest was football and soccer. Mm-hmm. I also was on the track team. I did various things on the track team. I threw the discus.
You sound like a Jim Thorpe type of guy.
Hardly. I wasn't the athlete, really. But my truth sport was really soccer. And I played soccer in high school and in college. And actually when we were living in outside of Paris, when I was in elementary school. And so soccer was my thing, and it wasn't a very popular sport. This was before Pelé. Before Pelé came, you know, to New York. But it was after I was encouraged by the team at Howard University that won the national championship. And
that was historic.
It was. And actually they won it twice, but they were stripped once of it.
Right.
You know, and then they persevered and then they became champion again. And at the championship down, when they were down in Miami at the Orange Bowl, we were on a fishing trip with my father, my brother, and my grandfather too. And we were invited to the luncheon there in Miami that they were hosting after they won the championship. My father and my grandfather are both Howard University alumni and recipients of the Distinguished Howard University Alumni Award. Mm-hmm. I wanted to go to Howard, but my father being a professor at Tuskegee, that if you're going to college and I'm paying for it, you're going to Tuskegee.
Well, on that note, you know, I want to thank you. One last thing in terms of for our listeners, you know, how would you like your grandfather to be remembered?
I'd like him to be remembered as the person who introduced basketball to blacks for the first time on a wide scale, organized basis. There's a lot to unpack with my grandfather because in addition to, you know, his sporting career, he was also a advocate for social justice, both in Washington and in Virginia. And also as he thought he would be most remembered as the author of The Negro in Sports. And not to mention the Spalding handbook between 1910 and 1913, which was the first chronicling of African-American participation in athletics.
Well, as you can see, the grandson is also a writer.
Well, thank you.
And thank you for being on my show. I want to let our listeners to have one more time to make a donation here to Substation during our spring fundraising drive. The number to call in is 202-588-9739. That's 202-588-9739. 1-800-222-9739. I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Edward P. Henderson II. He's the author of Grandfather Black Basketball, The Life and Times of Dr. E.B. Henderson. My name is E. Ethelbert Miller. The show's On the Margin. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
The Collision, where sports and politics smash. Thursdays at 10 a.m. and on iTunes and Google Play. WPFW, Washington, D.C.
Come to the WPFW Open House this Saturday, 10 to 3 p.m. Greetings. This is Miyuki Williams, Interim General Manager of WPFW. Come meet programmers, LSB members, and other listeners just like yourself. You have an opportunity to drop off a check. There will be CDs for sale, books, and baked goods. It is free, but you have to register at Eventbrite. Go to WPFW Open House. See you this Saturday at 1990 K Street Northwest. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Code Pink Women for Peace is coming to you live from Washington, D.C. and New York City, Thursday at 11 a.m. Code Pink Radio is an energizing new program focused on ending wars and militarism and building a peace economy. Listen weekly to robust conversation and inspiration from grassroots peacemakers from places like Korea, Yemen, Venezuela, Palestine, and Iran, as well as peacemakers in our nation's capital who are confronting war hawks in the White House and in Congress and modeling the actions we want our government to take. Again, that's Code Pink Radio, Thursdays at 11 a.m. on Washington, D.C.'s WPFW and New York City's WBAI, an engaging hour of cutting-edge conversation not to be missed.
We are women of the world. We're from the east, south, north, and west.
WPFW, in partnership with Friends of the Congo, present The Centrality of Congo to Black Liberation. May 29th, 5 a.m. until 8 p.m., an exploration of what is happening in the DRC and why the Congo must matter to the whole of humanity around the globe. Through public affairs and music programming, we will lean into Frantz Fanon's teaching never to forget that the fate of all of us is at stake in the Congo. That's The Centrality of Congo to Black Liberation, 5 a.m. until 8 p.m., May 29th on WPFW. Building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
This is Rev Yearwood, and I am so excited to announce our new climate show, Think 100% Climate Friday. This show will keep you up to date on everything climate justice related in a rapidly changing world. We will discuss breaking news and updates on environmental issues, the climate crisis, COVID-19, and politics. This show will make tangible how the climate crisis is already impacting our lives and what you can do about it. So tune in every Friday at 9 o'clock a.m. right here on WPFW 89.3, your jazz and justice station.
Sophie's Parlor is the original women's radio collective. Wednesdays from 3 to 5 p.m., the best music divas on radio at 89.3 FM and sophiesparlor.blogspot.com.
Music is my life.
This is Mason Burns, son of D.C.'s Sandman Burns. On May 31st, my father's birthday, WPFW celebrates his life and legacy and the 40th anniversary of house music from 5 a.m. until midnight. Also at noon on that day, my family, DJ Cool, and Sam's friends would gather as the District of Columbia honors him with the street naming ceremony of Sandman Burns Way, located at Longfellow Park, 18th and M Streets Northwest. All are welcome to attend and be a part of DC's history. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Music is my life. Music is my life. Music is my life. Music is my life. Music is my life.
Come to the WPFW Open House this Saturday, 10 to 3 p.m. Greetings. This is Miyuki Williams, Interim General Manager of WPFW. Come meet programmers, LSB members, and other listeners just like yourself. You have an opportunity to drop off a check. There will be CDs for sale, books, and baked goods. It is free, but you have to register at Eventbrite. Go to WPFW Open House. See you this Saturday at 1990 K Street Northwest. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
social justice issue or movement can escape the spotlight of the Latino Media Collective. The Latino Media Collective delivers consequential coverage from the biggest countries in South America to the smallest enclaves.